Good morning, everyone. I welcome you all to this briefing on water quality in the Upper Mississippi Basin, nitrate, treatment costs, and the role of agriculture, organized by the Northeast Midwest Institute. My name is Sri Vedachalam, and I lead the Safe Drinking Water Research and Policy Program at the Institute. Later in the program, you'll hear from my colleagues Ankita Mandalia and Joe Vukovic, who are heavily involved in putting together this program. Special thanks to Senator Amy Klobuchar, whose office is co-sponsoring this event with us. Municipalities and states in the Northeast Midwest region confront serious challenges due to the aging water and wastewater infrastructure. Adding to that concern is the increasing costs of treatment associated with nitrate removal. The lawsuit from the Des Moines Water Works against the three upstream drainage districts a few years ago put this issue in spotlight. Although agriculture is a major contributor to nitrate in our water bodies and conservation a well-established practice to limit the discharge of nutrients, changing conditions such as droughts and heavier rain events could reshape our strategy to contain nutrient flow in our water bodies. The Institute is fortunate to have a reputation it can leverage in inviting topic experts that can speak on this issue. Today we have an excellent panel of speakers. They will cover topics such as conservation practices adopted by farmers, monitoring in the Upper Mississippi, trends in nitrate levels, and watershed modeling that explains the various interactions between land and water. My colleagues Joe and Ankita will also describe a study that we are doing that relates to this topic. Without further ado, I would now like to introduce our first panelist, Alyssa. Alyssa Charney is a policy specialist at the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition in Washington, D.C., advocating for federal food and policy reform. She leads NSAC's work on farm bill conservation and also works on organic agriculture, climate change, and the annual appropriations process. Alyssa holds an MS in Agriculture and Food Policy and an MPH from Tufts University, as well as a BA in Environmental Studies from Vassar. She has worked on food and agriculture policy at the Center for Rural Affairs, New England Farmers Union, and the National School to Farm Network. Alyssa, please join me.
Thanks so much, and thanks everyone for joining us today. I'm going to get us started and talk about the intersection between water quality, conservation, and opportunities in the upcoming Farm Bill. Just to give you a sense of where I'm coming from, a little bit about NSAC, the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition. We're an alliance of organizations all around the country. We've been working to improve federal food and farm policy for nearly 30 years. The way we do this and the reason that we very much see farmers as part of the equation as we work to improve water quality is that we base our policy in the farmers, the stakeholders, the folks who are on the ground being impacted and understanding these federal programs as well as the challenges that they're up against. We get that feedback from our member organizations who are working directly with farmers on the ground across the country. From there, we take that feedback and we work to set priorities each year to advocate for change when it comes to agriculture policy, and we work with Congress and with USDA to improve federal programs. So specifically, I work on working lands conservation programs. So these are federal conservation programs that allow farmers to simultaneously keep their land in agricultural production while also adopting conservation activities on that land to address natural resource concerns, with water quality very much being at the top of that list. The two largest working lands programs are the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, EQIP, and the Conservation Stewardship Program, CSP. These programs both support farmers in adopting conservation activities on their land in production. They however, do it very differently. EQIP is targeted cost share for adopting specific conservation activities, and I'll highlight relevant activities as we move forward. So they're getting reimbursement for a percentage of that activity that they're adopting on their land in production. This differs from the Conservation Stewardship Program, which is whole farm comprehensive conservation assistance. So farmers are not just enrolling for a specific activity or multiple activities, but rather they're enrolling their entire land in that contract and addressing multiple resource concerns on all of that land. And they're rewarded both for the new activities that they take on over the course of their contract, as well as their baseline level of conservation when they come in. And then finally, the Regional Conservation Partnership Program, or RCPP, a new program in the 2014 Farm Bill, works, brings together conservation partners and producers to implement projects that are targeted at particular resource concerns, particular regions across the country. And it pulls its funding from a number of places, one of which is those underlying conservation programs, including EQIP, CSP, as well as the Agricultural Conservation Easement Program. So just to give us a sense of the types of conservation practices that we're talking about, I know there are a lot of numbers up on this screen, but these are the conservation practices that are available through EQIP. These numbers correspond with practice codes, so these practices are based in the work that USDA's Natural Resource Conservation Service does to establish the scientific basis for how these practices need to be implemented to address the resource concerns we're talking about. They're updated and modified approximately every 5 years. So in addition to the Farm Bill, that's another way that we shape and influence the real specifics, the nitty-gritty of how these practices work. And the range of practices that is available is pretty significant. There are over nearly 200 practices that are available through EQIP, which quite honestly is rather overwhelming. So at NSAC, we like to highlight and point to some of the particular activities that are available. So just a list here, different types of conservation cover, whether that's crop rotation, cover crops. We're also talking about really critical ways to keep nutrients from going into the water, so buffer strips, filter strips, grass waterways, nutrient management, so doing that plan and thinking about the application of nutrients on land that is eventually going to make its way into waterways. Prescribed grazing, also recognizing that the way livestock are managed on the operation very much influence the nutrients that are also making their way to the water, as well as forest buffers, cover, and stream crossing. So again, thinking about the implications of that full landscape and how livestock as well as humans are impacting that landscape. And then within EQIP, I also just wanted to highlight nutrient management plans. So through EQIP, there's what are called conservation activity plans, or CAPs, and these allow producers to adopt a plan that specifically addresses a key resource concern. So in this case, it is your nutrient management. You can also think about your grazing practices, organic transition, and the way that it both benefits farmers as well as the resource concerns that they are addressing is that they get funding to pay for a certified technical service provider, or a TSP, to help them make that plan, which will then be implemented as part of their management of practices and the resources on their land. And then I wanted to move and just highlight some of the particular activities that are available through the Conservation Stewardship Program to address water quality. CSP has what is referred to as enhancements. So rather than conservation practices, they have enhancements. This is reflective of the fact that CSP activities are going above and beyond. So you're taking that baseline level practice and building on that to adopt additional high-level management of particular activities. Just recently, NRCS made some major changes to CSP to directly link conservation practices through EQIP to conservation enhancements in CSP. And so that's what these kind of complex and crazy looking numbers refer to, that those first three letters of those, or those first three numbers of each enhancement, so 391, 393, 512, those are the corresponding practices that are based, again, in the EQIP practice standard developed through NRCS, and then they build on that to address particular resource concerns, kind of take it to that next level within CSP. So these are just a couple of examples of the many, many enhancements that are available that address water quality, increasing that riparian forest buffer to address nutrient reduction, filter strips, managing livestock, again, looking at both the livestock and crop management side of things, looking at the role of grass-based agriculture versus cropland, converting that to address nutrient management, looking at cover as well as improving nutrient uptake from the crop and the way that you're managing that land. The last piece on CSP that I wanted to touch on is what are referred to as bundles. So CSP has enhancements, which are the individual conservation activities that participants can adopt, and then also pull together those enhancements in a package, in a suite that recognizes kind of the co-benefits of adopting multiple activities at once. These are called bundles because we're bundling the enhancements together. So this is just one example that's specifically focused in on buffers. It addresses water quality degradation as well as several other resource concerns. Again, based in those conservation practices that are originating through EQIP, so filter strip, conservation cover, and tree and shrub establishment. And then from there, they adopt two additional enhancements, filter strip extension and conservation cover. And they have some flexibility as well to pick one additional enhancement, so trying to ensure that it works for the particular operation. And then the payment rates are reflective of that complexity and kind of the co-benefits of adopting multiple enhancements together. So I just wanted to touch on one other what falls into the working lands bucket of NRCS conservation programs. This is actually through the Conservation Reserve Program, which we typically think of as more land retirement, taking land, highly sensitive land, out of production, which is indeed what CRP does. It's administered through the Farm Service Agency, but there is a continuous component, which means that participants can enroll at any time. It's not just a general sign-up in the same way. And it's focused in on partial field enrollments, so not just taking entire acreages, entire farms out of production, but rather targeting those particular practices where they're really needed and allowing participants to adopt riparian buffers, saturated buffers, filter strips, grass waterways, wetland restoration, really getting at the types of activities that are targeted at water quality. So a really core working lands component of the Conservation Reserve Program. Right now, new enrollments in the continuous component of CRP are suspended because they don't have the acres to be enrolling that. We hope to see that start up again in 2018, but again, just a major piece of the Farm Bill conservation puzzle when it comes to improving water quality. Just want to highlight a couple of Farm Bill opportunities to build upon this tool set that farmers do have when it comes to NRCS conservation programs within EQIP, so that targeted cost share that is available. At NSAC, we really want to see that there can be higher cost share rates for those management practices that are getting at that high level conservation activities, whether we're talking about conservation cover or your tillage system. Those should be reflective of the time and investment and as well as the foregone income that goes into that. And then also make it easy and possible for participants once they do adopt some of those more individual activities through EQIP to then graduate to the Conservation Stewardship Program where they're taking on more whole farm conservation activities, making that easier for field staff, for farmers, for everyone out in the field to take that conservation to the next level. And then within the Conservation Stewardship Program, looking at how can we truly ensure that we are incentivizing high-level activities? One of those options is ensuring that when we think about soil health, when we think about water quality, we're thinking about the cropland side of things, but also the livestock. So can we ensure that we are incentivizing high-level grazing, management-intensive rotational grazing? Another key part of CSP in the next Farm Bill is thinking about the planning process. There is a lot that needs to go into farmers to think about addressing resource concerns on their entire operation. So ensure that they can be receiving payments for that activity of thinking about how am I comprehensively addressing all resource concerns. And then finally, ensuring that the payment rates for these activities are increased to provide NRCS with the flexibility it needs to set payment rates that are truly reflective of the benefits that we're getting from the adoption of these practices. So just one additional piece that I want to touch on, that it's really key to The impact of these federal conservation programs when it comes to water quality is the need for measurement, evaluation, and reporting of the conservation outcomes associated with these programs. Right now, NRCS can definitely tell us a lot about the implementation of these programs when it comes to the number of contracts, the number of acres, the number of dollars that are going to the adoption of these practices. What they can't tell us is the specific impact of how many tons of nitrogen were kept out of the water as a result of EQIP, as a result of CSP, as a result of the specific practices for CSP. So this next Farm Bill really presents an opportunity to give USDA that authority to do that measurement, to be linking up with all of the other folks who are key to this process, and then using that information to be accountable to taxpayers, to tell them this is the impact that your taxpayer dollars are having on our water quality, and also to benefit farmers, to say, okay, it seems like this practice is not working as well as we thought it was to do what we wanted to do based on this information that we're now getting by having better data on these programs. We can further improve how these programs and practices are working for farmers. So a really key opportunity that we see as a win-win-win for farmers, for conservation outcomes, as well as for taxpayers who are supporting the adoption of these key practices. So with that, lots of information to stay in touch, and I will turn it over.
Thank you, Alyssa. Our next speaker is Kelly Warner. She's a hydrologist with the USGS, U.S. Geological Survey. She's been with the USGS for over 20 years with expertise in water quality, groundwater, and continuous nutrient monitoring. The focus of her research is on nutrients and arsenic. Kelly is the Deputy Director for Investigations at the Illinois, Iowa, Missouri Water Science Center. Is that a new addition?
It is a new addition.
And coordinates research for the center. Kelly received a BA from Knox College and MS from Northern Illinois University. Go Huskies! Kelly has been an integral part of the U.S. Geological Survey National Water Quality Assessment, NAQUA program as Regional Aquifer Coordinator, where she led a team of hydrologists from Maine to Washington in investigations of water quality of the glacial aquifer system. Kelly.
Thank you, Sheree. So, as he said, I'm Kelly Warner with U.S. Geological Survey, which is a science agency that's part of the Department of Interior. And we do a lot of research on nitrate. We monitor nitrate, but we also do modeling. We look at the ecosystems. We look at effects and changes on nutrients. But a foundation of all of that is in the data. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about what we're doing for real-time tracking of nutrients and some of the new methods that are allowing us to have a better understanding of nutrients. We worked with a bunch of different groups and constituencies, and they all have a vested interest. The states, for example, have a vested interest in nutrients because every state in the Upper Mississippi River Basin has a nutrient loss reduction strategy. Working with the Gulf Hypoxia Task Force, they've all come up with these nutrient strategies, and a key part of those is monitoring and determining how the changes are, what changes are occurring in the nutrients leaving the state. The water utilities have a vested interest in the nutrients because of the cost. You may have heard a few years ago about the Des Moines lawsuit. Des Moines said that it was going to cost them $80 million to treat for nitrate at their one facility. So they have a vested interest in nutrients. In the Upper Mississippi River Basin, we get a lot of tourism because of recreation for lakes, rivers, and streams. And we saw in 2015, for example, an unprecedented harmful algal bloom down the Ohio River, about 650 miles, affected five states. Over 5 million people had their drinking water affected. So harmful algal blooms, which are related to nutrient concentrations, are also of interest in the area. And then industries and fisheries. We were at a meeting a few weeks ago in St. Louis, and the mayor of St. Louis said that Anheuser-Busch was having to filter their water four times, giving them extra cost to get their water to a quality that they wanted for their product. So industries also have a very vested interest in knowing what the nutrients are and when the nutrients are coming down the stream or might be affecting them. What is the USGS doing? Well, historically, we've collected discrete samples. We go out and we collect the sample, we send it to the lab, we get the results, and that is really the basis of a lot of our models, a lot of our trends, of the information we have out there. But there's new technologies now that the USGS is starting to implement, where we're able to look at nutrients in real time. We're able to continuously find the concentrations by putting sensors in the stream that measure nitrate, for example, every 15 minutes and measure phosphate every couple hours. And then the telemetry is shown in the slide. We're able to get that back to the offices and available to the public in real time. So you think about how much information that is at one site with nitrate being collected every 15 minutes. And one of the reasons that we've been, or one of the areas that we've been putting these, are where we have USGS gauging stations. Now, there's a lot of benefits for us for doing that because we know that nutrient loads affect Gulf hypoxia. And by loads, we're talking about the nitrate concentration and the amount of flow. So you need to know the flow in the stream also. So when we put them at USGS gauging stations where we have flow, we call them super gauges because they have that extra water quality component. But we're able to determine nutrient loads when we do this. Also, when we put them in a USGS gauging station, we have the infrastructure there. If we have a nitrate sensor where we're able to use the telemetry to get the information back right away, it becomes available much quicker. In the Upper Mississippi River Basin, there are about 700 different USGS gauges where we could put continuous nutrient sensors. Currently, we have them at 38 different locations. Now, of those 38 different locations, a lot of those continuous nitrate sensors are for specific issues or projects. They may be short-term projects trying to answer a specific question. Only four of those sites are part of the U.S. Geological Survey's National Water Quality Program that's looking at longer-term trends. So expanding that network would give us a fuller understanding of the entire basin. The long-term data is very important. The Northeast Midwest Institute did a study several years ago looking at Lake Erie and at the phosphorus, and they determined that you needed about 10 years of data to really determine whether or not nutrients were changing in response to an agricultural practice. That's because we have lag times, we have legacy nutrients, and we have different climatic conditions that change from year to year. So you need longer-term data to be able to really understand what's happening in the system. This is an example that's showing the changes in nitrate concentrations at the Illinois River at Florence. It's one of the stations where we have the longer-term data of the continuous nitrate. So this graph is made up of nitrate concentrations collected every 15 minutes from 2012 till now. It's a lot of data. We've also had a study where we looked at trends in nitrate concentrations. It's a very large study, unprecedented, where we had over 180 million different water quality samples from over 600 different agencies, states, federal, tribal groups. And that data was brought together to look at what are the trends across the nation. One of the authors of that study, Lori Sprague, is right here too. But what I wanted to do is I wanted to also lay out for you that long-term data is still relatively sparse. Very few points where we have data 40 years. And each decade, we seem to have more and more sites where we have longer-term data. If you look at the 2002 to 2012, you'll see that in the Upper Mississippi River Basin, it looks like nitrate concentrations are decreasing. But it's not uniform. There are some areas where you see the red dots going up where nitrate is increasing. It begs the question, is what's the overall balance? Are the increases offsetting the decreases? It's one of the further questions that we have to ask. And an additional question from that also occurs is, when do those nutrients hit the streams? And that's where the real-time tracking comes in and helps. I'm going to give you a couple examples of where we've been using this real-time nutrient tracking. Every state, as I said, has a nutrient loss reduction strategy because of the Gulf hypoxia issue. And in Illinois, we have put up a super gauge where we have flow and nitrate and phosphate concentrations at all the major river basins leaving the state. Those basins represent more than 75% of the land area in the state. So the state of Illinois will be able to determine over a longer period of time how are the nutrient concentrations that are leaving the state changing. We also have been working with the Metropolitan Water District in Greater Chicago because they're interested. They've been implementing different technologies to reuse and recycle the nutrients from the water supply there. And that decrease, they found up to 40% reduction. And so we have another super gauge we've put in the upper part of the state looking at where Chicago influences the Illinois River. A last example is where we've been working with the city of Cedar Rapids and employing these real-time nutrient sensors. We have a sensor in the Cedar River. That's the top graph, the top line here in green. In the Cedar River, with our continuous nitrate concentrations, the city, which is downstream, uses groundwater wells to get their drinking water. And that's very common in the Upper Mississippi River Basin because we put wells next to streams so that we can induce infiltration and try to get more water to the wells. Well, what the city has found is if they look at the concentrations in the river coming down the stream, they can determine when they need to turn on different wells, when they need to turn off different wells, or when they need to mix the water between groundwater and surface water. So it gives them a little forecasting of what they could expect for nutrient concentrations in their drinking water. So finally, I want to say that using some of these new technologies, we're going to get a better understanding and open up some more opportunities. I think one of the things for sure is that we'll be able to look more at events. When do nutrients come into the stream? And we know that major source of nutrients come in during floods or during high flow events. So with the continuous sensor, it's hard to get out there and get individual samples during the really high flow events. But with the continuous sensors, we might be able to get a better understanding of what happens during those really high flow event times. We could probably get a better understanding of sources. We could look at how all the BMPs and the implementation and investments that farmers have done to reduce nutrients, how that's affecting our streams. And finally, that we could take the models and the forecasting that we're trying to do, and we can put that data-intense information into those models to help refine those models. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Kelly. Next up, we have Jeff Beckler. He's co-founder of North Water Consulting, a specialty water resources consulting firm established in 2010. Jeff is a senior water resource specialist with over 15 years' experience in both public and the private sector. Jeff has been recognized for his lead role in the design and development of SWAM, a custom geospatial watershed assessment and management model. The tool supports assessment, monitoring, and management of non-point source pollution and is currently used by many governments and organizations throughout the United States. Jeff has also developed as an expert in assessing and improving lakes and streams that serve diverse economic and environmental functions. He has directly served leadership roles on regional initiatives in the Midwest that addresses the Gulf of Mexico hypoxia and major environmental issues related to the Great Lakes. Jeff.
Thank you. Very happy to be here, and thank you for having me. I've kind of geared my talk towards decision makers, and I'm going to try and give you kind of like a private consultant or a private industry perspective on all these things. That's how I'm kind of trying to approach it. So I'm going to start off by talking a little bit about my company, just to provide some perspective. And when I talk to my friends about what I do, they don't believe me, so I have to provide examples. So founded in 2010, I actually used to work for state government, decided to get into the consulting in 2010 with another business partner. We are a true small business, so we are well under the $15 million size limit for small businesses. There are two owners, myself and another geologist, and we have three full-time employees. One of those is employed in Haiti. We are right now exploring, due to workload, additional hires, and we really focus on surface water and groundwater management. We don't typically do engineering work. We're more kind of applied sciences research and that type of thing. So our primary clients, government, municipalities are a big client domestically. We do a lot of NGO, non-governmental organizational work in third world countries. We do some work for industry in terms of permitting and other industry groups such as the Farm Bureau, for example. We are heavily tied to international aid programs, regulatory compliance, and clean water programs through the EPA. And I'm going to talk about a few of those. So some project highlights, just to give you some context of, for further slides. We recently helped a mining company secure a permit and save money and improve wetlands all at the same time. So it was kind of a win-win. We got a permit approved, and everybody made out better in the end. We work for multiple water commissions that provide drinking water, primarily to more rural areas. We helped a water commission increase their reservoir capacity by 12% just by keeping sediment out of the lake by doing targeted implementation and practices in parts of the watershed. And recently wrapping up a large project for another public water supply called Lake Movistar, west of Springfield, Illinois. To reduce loading, we planned, engineered, and installed hundreds of practices to reduce loading to that reservoir through various federal programs that, you know, I'm kind of hoping to plug with this presentation as well. So, the big picture. Nutrient loading in the U.S. is a huge problem and one of the most widespread problems we're dealing with right now, primarily coming from fertilizer, agricultural areas, human and animal waste, and sewage treatment plants. So sewage treatment plants actually produce a very high percentage of nutrient loading, specifically phosphorus. Nutrient loading leads to algal blooms that can create all sorts of issues. Some stats from the Hypoxia Task Force. So tourism industry loses almost $1 billion per year due to nutrient pollution alone. The Gulf of Mexico, everybody's heard of the dead zone. In 2017, that was 8,776 square miles. A lot of that increase in size is due to large precipitation events. But roughly every year 1.4 million tons of nitrogen and 140,000 tons of phosphorus enter the Gulf, leading to the hypoxia zone. The Hypoxia Task Force calls for a 20% reduction by 2035. Individual states are also trying to reduce nutrient loading and have their own targets. So, in Illinois, the nutrient loss reduction strategy, it's a strategy for reducing nutrients because Illinois is one of the largest producers of nitrogen and phosphorus to the Gulf, has a 45% reduction strategy for nitrogen and phosphorus. A recent USDA study estimates that the cost to public drinking water sources of removing nitrate is roughly $4.8 billion per year. I work with a lot of public water supplies, and a big fear of theirs is, do we have to install costly treatment systems to deal with increased nutrient loads, specifically nitrogen? For example, the city of Decatur, which is a fairly small community in central Illinois, recently spent millions of dollars to install a nitrate treatment system that they really only have to turn on every once in a while, but they exceeded the standard in the lake for the nitrate drinking water that led to them having to install the system, raised rates on users, and really just costed a lot of money. If they would have reduced loading to the watershed, been able to do that, they probably wouldn't have had to invest that type of money. So Lake Springfield, I live in Springfield. Lake Springfield is our water supply. Recently did some modeling for that watershed to determine loads reaching it. I estimate for the 160,000 acre watershed that roughly 2.3 million pounds per year of nitrogen enters it every year. 213,000 pounds of phosphorus and quite a bit of sediment enters that reservoir every year. That is a challenge in terms of water treatment and costly to deal with this. So just to treat the watershed and to get, you know, reductions, but not the reductions they actually need to meet water quality standards, we estimate it will cost the city almost $150 million to install practices throughout the watershed to get reductions close to 50% of what's coming in. Almost 95% reductions are actually needed to meet phosphorus standards in the watershed. So that's a lot of money to get you half of the way. Another great example from Arkansas, the Beaver Water District. It's a water supply reservoir, serves 350,000 customers. A lot of those are wholesale customers, so there's actually probably a lot more customers than 350,000 because those wholesale customers also serve other communities. Very large watershed. Nutrient and sediment loading starting to impact water quality. They did an economic study of doing nothing and what it would cost the water district to treat water if pollution got worse, if nutrient loading got worse. And what they determined was that if they do source water protection, deal with the problem before it happens, they're actually a net benefit. So it's actually cheaper to protect the watershed, less expensive to protect the watershed than to do nothing. Almost 1.5 times more benefit to actually deal with the problems before they happen. So some of the challenges, I work with a lot of rural communities. Some of the big challenges that they face, obviously dwindling tax revenue. Small communities that really don't have a lot of money to fix streets, let alone deal with water quality issues in large watersheds. Aging water infrastructure, everything's falling apart. It all needs to be replaced. There's just no money to do it. Legacy pollution. This is a big problem in reservoirs. These nutrients end up sitting in the sediment. They're released. It's very difficult to get that out of the system when it's already in it. It's about really important to protect the watersheds from it happening in the first place. The cost of the problem typically exceeds the available resources. I gave you some examples from Lake Springfield. That is well above their annual budget, $150 million. Small wastewater treatment plants have a very difficult time actually upgrading to meet standards. Costly treatment plant upgrades are just well outside of their ability to pay for them without assistance, loans, and things like that. Cutbacks in federal programs that offer assistance are starting to diminish. And then other cutbacks in programs that are essential that are provided by government are also having impacts. So USGS monitoring, for example, we rely heavily as a private company on these USGS gauges. We recently completed a modeling project that when we build a predictive model, we need to calibrate it to actual real-world water quality information so it's predictive. If we didn't have flow data in this particular watershed from the USGS, we would have no ability to actually calibrate our model. So critical components that government provides also helps the private sector. The good news, so there is some good news. That sounded bad, but there is some good news. Number one, federal programs through the U.S. EPA and the U.S. Department of Agriculture are helping communities deal with the problem by providing grants and cost-share assistance. The Section 319 program, which is a really important program, provides direct funding to install practices to treat the watershed, as does USDA programs like the RCPP program and other continuous CRP, for example. These federal programs are starting to focus more on targeting resources to the areas that they need the most. That's extremely important, so more efficient use of federal dollars. They help leverage other money. So the 319 program, for example, which we do a lot of work with, provides only 60% cost share. 40% has to come from somewhere else. Oftentimes, communities that don't have 100% of the money can come up with 40%, for example. So it actually stimulates more by leveraging additional dollars. That's critically important. It's not just a handout. It actually helps stimulate and encourage others to spend money. Encourages landowners to participate in improving the watershed. So those that really care, they're already doing the work. The ones that we want to work with typically need some sort of incentive. Maybe it's a cash incentive, maybe it's educating, things like that, but these programs through financial incentives help encourage action. They stimulate the private sector. So I pay effectively 40% in taxes. Every project that I work on through a federal grant, 40% of that goes back into the tax system. That's not just myself, that's contractors building these things. That money gets recirculated back into the economy. And so we are actually getting results, and we can quantify those. In Illinois, for example, if you see between 2002 and 2011, the load reductions for phosphorus, nitrogens, and sediment, between 2011 and 2015, substantial increases. That's through programs like Section 319, USDA Farm Bill programs, for example. So huge accomplishments, huge benefits and results. We're seeing results in reductions in nutrient loading. So what's my point? The point is the problem's not going away, and we are making progress, but it's important to keep the momentum going. So between 1980 and 1996 in Illinois, nitrogen was at load for the state was roughly 400 million pounds per year. between 2011 and 2015, we saw a reduction in roughly 10%. Phosphorus has increased in the same period. That's likely a result of wastewater treatment plants. But my point is that we are making progress, and it's really important to keep the ball rolling rather than just cut it off and go backwards. Federal funding is extremely important and critical for leveraging other funds. Like I said, it encourages others to invest their money. It stimulates in economic growth. And in my opinion, it's a return on investment. Local contractors, small businesses such as mine, rely heavily on a lot of these things. In Waverly Lake, for example, 100% of these grant programs went to the private sector. Did not go to hire employees. It specifically went to contractors and other private companies to actually execute the grants. They support government services, immensely important for the private sector and to ensure that your tax dollars are spent efficiently. So, that's it. That's all I have.
Thank you, Jeff. Next, we'll have two of my colleagues, Ankita and Joe, talk about our ongoing study on the Mississippi and the impact it'll have on some of the policy measures that are likely to happen in Congress. Ankita Mandelia started working at the Northeast Midwest Institute in 2016 as a policy analyst for the Towards Sustainable Water Information Program. She focuses on research and policy education support for the program and on the Mississippi River Basin. She also manages the availability of water quality data for the entire Northeast Midwest region. Prior to joining the Institute, she was the first Michigan Sea Grant Fellow at the International Joint Commission, Great Lakes Regional Office. Ankita holds a Master of Science degree in Environmental Engineering from Michigan Technological University and a Bachelor of Science from, the State School up North? The University of Michigan. I went to Ohio State, so I'm not supposed to say the name. She will be followed by Joe Vukovic. He is the Senior Policy Analyst for the Mississippi River Basin Program. He provides research and policy analysis on matters of water and environmental policy for the Mississippi River Basin Program. He also serves as a point of contact for Capitol Hill offices and a resource for the Institute's policy education initiatives. Most recently, Joe worked as a legislative fellow for Congressman Matt Cartwright before joining the Institute. He holds a Bachelor of Science in Physics from Carnegie Mellon University and a Juris Doctor and Master of Public Policy degrees from Georgetown. At Georgetown, he served on the Georgetown Environmental Law Review and was a Public Interest Fellow. Ankita?
Good morning. Thank you for coming. And I'm going to give you an overview of the study that we're doing in the Mississippi River Basin. The objective of our study is to quantify the effect of nutrient loading on drinking water treatment costs in the upper Mississippi River Basin. This study will be carried out in three phases. The first phase will be to select the study sites. The second phase will be to manipulate and play with different scenarios of nitrogen loading in the upper Mississippi River Basin. And then the results of that study that manipulation will be used for the third phase of the study to conduct the cost analysis of drinking water treatment for nitrate. So the first phase of the project is to select study sites. These are the sites that are in yellow are potential study sites. We're currently in various stages of contacting these municipalities and utilities to see if they will cooperate with us for our study. The way that the sites are selected is based on criteria based on how large the utility is, what kind of population the utility serves, and what kind of land use there is in the watershed that leads to that the drinking water intake is located in. The ultimate selection of potential of study sites will be based on this criteria as well as who is able to give us information. The second phase of the study will be to use USGS's spatially referenced regression on watershed attributes, more commonly known as the Sparrow model, to manipulate, incrementally manipulate different types of nutrient loading in the upper Mississippi River Basin at these five sites, at the five sites' watersheds. And the idea is that we would have different quantities of nutrient loading from, say, agricultural loading versus CAFOs, and be able to take those loadings and use them in the third phase of the project, which is the cost analysis. The quantities of those loadings will be used to they'll be taken into account in the cost analysis, where we'll quantify nitrogen loading from different sources and connect the different loading sources to treatment costs to determine which of those sources has the most impact on drinking water treatment costs. So the expected outcome is to connect nutrient loading to drinking water treatment costs and to show if this connection is significant and which sources are most significant in changing the water quality of drinking water influent. And now I'm going to turn it over to Joseph.
All right. Hello, everyone. As Ankit said, my name is Joe Vukovic, and I'm going to talk to you about some of the policy impacts that we expect from our study. And I'll try not to take too long, so I want to leave enough time for questions. Fortunately, you've heard a lot of what I'm going to say from our distinguished panelists already, so don't need to dwell on the big picture too much, but you know, we've been talking a lot about the nutrient pollution problems in the Mississippi Basin. And multiple people before me have used Des Moines as kind of a case study of why this is such an important issue. So I won't dwell on it too much, except to note that great minds think alike. So here are some of the impacts that we hope to see from this study, both in terms of the research itself and some of the conversations that we think we can have surrounding this study. So just briefly, I'll introduce the things that I'm going to talk about here, and we'll go into more detail one by one. So just monitoring conservation practices, specifically with respect to the Farm Bill, and then what I refer to as building constituencies. So you know, one of the things that it's important to keep in mind with this study, and we're using the Sparrow model, but Sparrow is not a replacement for empirical data. It's something that complements the need for monitoring in the way that Kelly spoke about before me. So, you know, there are multiple ways that policymakers can think about how to bring that increased monitoring into play. We'd love to see USGS have the resources to continue to expand what they're doing, but there are certainly alternative strategies or complementary strategies that could be pursued as well. Sorry, I don't know. I keep accidentally changing slides here. And then in terms of the Farm Bill, this is probably the core of what we think our study can help accomplish in terms of a finding that it's more cost-effective to use these conservation practices to reduce pollution in the first place, as opposed to treating it once it gets to the utility, would be a very strong argument for the need to continue to strengthen and improve and protect these conservation programs as we go through the process of drafting the next Farm Bill in the coming year. And then finally, this is an opportunity for what I sometimes refer to as building constituencies. So just developing the relationships with offices and with members and with organizations to make sure that this research is disseminated in a way that's helpful to them and that can inform them as they think about these decisions for the policy issues. And so part of that is our outreach to individual offices. We have a great relationship with a good number and a growing number of offices, but also like to highlight the importance of revitalizing caucuses and coalitions on the Hill, specifically things like the Mississippi River Caucus or the Upper Mississippi Task Force. And I don't mean to suggest that those groups are defunct or not or non-existent, because they are existent, they do good work, but at the same time there's always the opportunity to revitalize those and make sure that they're kind of carrying the ball forward and doing the important work and continuing to have these conversations. And then finally, just want to note that the Institute is fortunate enough to have a lot of partner organizations that we work with throughout the Northeast Midwest region, and the Upper Mississippi Basin is no exception to that. And we hope that this work that we're doing, this study, will be a resource for them as they work with their representatives in Congress, but also with state and local decision makers and community groups. So I said I would be quick. I tried to go as quick as I can. So now I'd just like to open it up for questions for any of our panelists. So, and thank you for coming today, and thank you again to Senator Klobuchar's office for making this possible.
We're open for questions now. Yes.
So, Alyssa and Kelly, maybe y'all can tag team this one a little bit. Alyssa, you talked about how we're looking at getting some CSP, some ways to demonstrate the results that we're getting from these conservation practices. Does that mean getting edge of field monitoring into, because you know, if we know the nutrients are coming, we kind of know they're coming in on big water events, but the gauges or where the gauges are, to really know if these practices, whether CSP practices or prep or whatever the case may be, are they really contributing in a reduction to nutrient loading? To know that, don't we kind of have to have the edge of field monitoring to get that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely a part of the solution, is getting down to that field level to figure out, okay, we're not just talking on the landscape scale, we're talking about exactly where this practice was implemented, what was the impact. So I think that's very much a part of the solution, and I think for us, the reason why we do see the need for a broad coalition, so having the folks with the monitoring tools and experience at the table to kind of help USDA shape what exactly does this process look like, so we can get the information we need.
And I think that we definitely need that kind of tiered approach. You need to know the edge of the field, and USGS has been doing some of that edge of the field monitoring. We're finding that you have very different practices have very different outcomes and loads depending on where they're located. So if you had that edge field monitoring where you could look at different practices in different areas, tier that up to a smaller local watershed to see how it's impacting the watershed, and then ultimately, as we're talking about with the real-time gauges, some of the larger, to see how it, you can't extrapolate it across, that's your point, I think, or one of the points, is you can't extrapolate one practice across a large area because not the same practice works or affects nutrient loadings in every area.
Yeah, and if I could just add to that, so how we do that now is we estimate the loading to that point, and then we have actually, they're just essentially just literature-based removal efficiencies, and that gives us our reduction. There's just very little edge of field monitoring to draw from, and like she said, there's it's just every practice functions just a little bit differently. A filter strip here is not as effective as a filter strip on a, you know, different soil or a different slope, for example. So extremely important to have that edge of field. Yeah, it's right now we're kind of making educated guesses and averages.
In addition to the measuring the water quality improvements, I think it would be really helpful to document the costs of the practices put in place, that where you see the water quality improvements to the actual drinking water treatment costs. So what would the cost be for implementing all these practices versus installing drinking water treatment for the nutrients? And I think there's been a couple documented cases of that, but I think it'd be really helpful to see more of that just to make the business case for putting these practices in place versus, you know, doing this standard drinking water infrastructure improvements with, you know, treatment, and, you know, just as a return on investment for water utilities in particular.
Definitely. Well, and the example I gave of Beaver Water District, I mean, I think, you know, that's a different watershed too. So that one is actually mostly forested. There's not a lot of agriculture. Actually, what they're more afraid of is development. Most of the development's kind of on the fringe of the watershed. It's creeping in. I'm not aware of a similar study done, for example, in Lake Springfield, where 90% of the entire watershed is row crop agriculture. So I think having that in maybe some different types of watersheds and water supplies would be extremely helpful.
I have a question about the gauges. You mentioned there are 700 potential sites and currently 38 being deployed. How are the ones that are actually doing the continuous monitoring chosen? How are those 38 chosen versus the 700 potential? And what is the prognosis for expanding the number of those?
That's a very good question. So with the USGS, we work with different groups that come to the table if they're another taxing entity, and we try to help answer science questions. So a lot of those are chosen because a county or a city comes and says, you know, we're having this problem and we don't know where, you know, where is it coming from, or how's the nitrate being transported? And so the USGS will come in and to help answer those questions, install a monitoring station to be able to help answer it. So that's why they're chosen, or that's why those 38 are there. Four of them are part of it. So the USGS also has a National Water Quality Program. And as part of that, we have a network across the nation where we've had long-term data and we're continuously monitoring. So four of them are part of that. There is a plan that we've put together where we've looked at the whole Mississippi River Basin and where would be the most beneficial sites to have to be able to come up with a full understanding of the nutrient loads in the Mississippi River Basin. I mean, I think we've identified about 34 sites where we currently have discrete sampling that's being done, that we think the continuous sampling might give us a better idea of loads and timing. And then we would kind of pair that with smaller basins. So we've been looking at that, and we have a plan. But that's why we have the 38. Four of them are longer term, so four of them won't go away, or at least if funding stays the same at the USGS, it wouldn't go away. Good question.
Going back to what we were saying a couple minutes ago about that no two fields are identical in terms of what are we going to do about this? There's this situation that happened out in Iowa, where, as I understand it, a city paid for agricultural best management practice reductions on farms upstream, right? And they had to drag the scientists from the state. And cautious here, but they had to get the scientists from the state to actually come out and look at it in order to get credit for it, because they wanted the reductions to affect their permit, the town. But so that, I mean, this is a personal thing. They were able to get the scientists, and then the scientists were able to sign off on it. But when is this going to be a commodity that, you know, a developer can buy, can go to a central facility like a state revolving fund and say, you know, have you got, you know, I need 100,000 pounds of, or 10,000 pounds of nitrogen credit for the work that I need to do.
Yeah,
where can I find them? Mm-hmm. And what price?
I think,
is that happening?
I think that is already happening.
It is. Nutrient trading is happening in some states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's not robust at all.
It's not robust, and it's not uniform across the states.
Right.
But I think it's still in the infancy. So they're still trying to work out the kinks. How do you trade one type of nitrogen for another? I mean, we're going to look to those states that are implementing it to see how it's being done.
What about the numbers?
What about the numbers for what?
Yeah, I mean, I'm Bechtel on my field here, and because I put the tiling in, the runoff's horrible now, right?
Yeah.
So how much, if I put in a 2-acre wetland to absorb all that, how much credit do I get?
And that's part
and
of what...
And can I sell them?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are good questions. I think that's the complexity of nutrient trading. I mean, that's part of the complexity is how do you allocate those credits? I know they're looking into it in some states. Nebraska, I think.
The importance of monitoring. That's another reason why monitoring is so important.
Yeah, that's true.
And different wetlands function differently, too. Some actually don't treat nutrients all that well if they have a large drainage area, for example, and heavy input. So
that is a future.
Mm-hmm. One final question.
My question's for Alyssa. I was wondering if you guys have talked about incentivizing polycrop practices for smaller farms as a way to diminish runoff from pesticides, just because it's a more sustainable way of growing crops. I know it's harder to get on as high of yields as monocrop practices, but it is kind of a sustainable way to diminish the runoff and use of pesticides.
Kelly, can you press on?
I think that's a really good question and definitely integral to a lot of the practices that are available through programs like CSP and EQIP when we talk about diversified crop rotations, resource-conserving crop rotations, doing as much as possible to ensure that the farmer is incentivized for that foregone income, recognizing that, you know, if they were to keep that in crop production all year long, they could get a higher income, but we are thinking about kind of the net value of those conservation benefits. There's also a lot in those programs to ensure that they are properly incentivized regardless of acreage. So there's a minimum payment within CSP right now of $1,500 a year. So even if you are doing small, intensive specialty crop production based on the activities that you're adopting, there's that minimum payment to ensure that we're talking about conservation at all scales and all sizes of fields. I think there's a lot in those programs and even more that can be done to ensure that they're working for those types of operations.
Thank you. Before we end, I just have one comment. We are still interested in adding more utilities as partners for the study. So if you are from a congressional office or you're from an organization that works with utilities or other groups and have networks that can connect us with these utilities in the basin, that would be really helpful. To conclude, great panel, great speakers, and a great set of questions. Thank you, everyone. Alyssa, Jeff, Kelly, Ankita, and Joe. This was a great panel, and I thank all of you for coming here. Thank you.
Thank you.